Episode 48.
I never get to a point where you just sit back and say, you know what, we've got this all figured out, because you're constantly training employees and just trying to strive to take care of every single customer, not let one slip through the cracks.
Welcome, aftermarketers. Prepare to learn just one thing from today's episode and take action on your journey to remarkable results. A warm welcome to Jeff Matt from Victory Auto Service and Glass from Minneapolis and St. Petersburg, Florida. Jeff, are you ready to share your remarkable results?
I'm ready to go, Carm.
Hello, Aftermarket Tribe. Carm Capriato here. Welcome to episode 48. Here's a first. Check out the latest blab on the subject of social media. This format will excite you because you are face-to-face with the discussion. I feel you will benefit in watching the blab because we had alumni Greg Buckley from episode 19, Doug Whiteman episode 9 and 10, and Kim Walker from episode 45. Now, that was two shop owners and one social media expert sharing their area of passion on the subject. Many great concepts, best practices, and ideas shared in the first of many Blab episodes specifically focused on the aftermarket service professional. Find the Blab replays on our website. Now, Jeff Matt, owner and founder of Victory Auto Service and Glass, a family-owned award-winning auto repair and glass business with six locations in Minnesota and Florida. Before opening Victory Auto in 1997, Jeff worked as an automotive technician and dreamed of opening a shop where the customer always felt cared for, never felt taken advantage of, and always received the highest quality service at the best price. Jeff opened the business as a small one-bay shop in a suburb of Minneapolis, and it now has expanded to 40 employees in five metro locations in Minnesota and one location in St. Petersburg, Florida. Jeff knew from the beginning that he wanted to use his skills to be a blessing to those in his community by providing free and low-cost repairs to those in need. In 2003, Victory Auto began to partner with Minnesota non-for-profit Free to Be, which was recently renamed Cars for Neighbors, and that was to provide free and discounted auto services to individuals and families suffering from financial hardships. Since then, Victory has donated in kind more than $500,000 to Free to Be. Jeff has donated dozens of cars and thousands of dollars in repairs over the years to individuals in need in his own community who were brought to his attention. In 2011, Jeff received an 11 Who Care Award from a local Minnesota TV station for his charitable work with Free to Be. Victory Auto was also honored with a prestigious Integrity Award in 2010 from the Better Business Bureau. Three of their locations received an Angie's Super Service Award in 2014 and 15. And they were also named a top shop by Motor Age magazine in 2014, and they just received the 2015 Minnesota Business Ethics Award. We cover a lot of ground about being a multi-shop owner, his 20 group, and the impact having a business coach has had on his business. He is resolute on his main mission to recruit and develop the right people on his team because it interconnects with his personal drive to create a strong family-type culture inside the business. Get out your pad and pencil or your digital note taker. Here we go. Wow, Jeff, a multi-shop owner both in Minneapolis and St. Petersburg. This is going to be a real interesting episode. Can't wait to hear about all these great questions I have about multi-shop owner. I'm pretty darn excited about that. So what made you dip your toe into the world of wanting to be a business owner?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was after several years of working for different people, and seeing that, I was doing most of the work, fixing the cars, building the relationships, and basically the owners would come in and, collect the money. And at some point there with one of the owners that I work for, it kind of got to a point where I got a little upset and just was determined to figure out the business side of things. And I knew the car side. I just figured that if everybody else could do it, then I should be able to figure it out. And I had really no idea, no background, no college, but just really became determined to figure out the business side of things.
A very typical answer that I usually get. Great tech, love to have their own spoils, but yet have no clue how to run a business.
Exactly, yeah. And I just figured that it's just a matter of, taking a little bit at a time and trying to figure out what it is step by step. So I just started asking a lot of questions, talking to different people, accountants, people that I trusted, and And I just figured I could just nip it off a little bit at a time. And at some point I would get there.
So when you reflect back on where you are today, and I know you're probably always reinventing yourself and trying to improve, but look back and tell me what your greatest strength as an entrepreneur. What's made you what you are today?
I think the one thing that I, you know, would humbly say is that I could fix cars, which I got pretty well at. But ultimately, I think the difference between me and a lot of guys that I work with that were other good technicians is I was able to communicate with the customers, and I was able to communicate something very technical and easy to understand terms. And I think that really resonated with people as I got started. I come to realize that that was something that was unique about me, and I was just being me. But I think that was the one thing that kind of empowered me. I said, well, if I can talk to the people and let them understand something that's highly complex and build the trust and build the relationship, that was really what most shops struggle with now.
So communications is it. So you made a bold move when you were younger to branch out and become a businessman. Was there ever another bigger, bolder move or decision you ever made?
Prior to starting, no, and probably nothing since. No, this was it. I had a good paying job, young kids. My kids were really young at the time. And, you know, to leave a good paying job with benefits with an employer that my employer offered me at the time, and this was now 20 years ago, he offered me a $10,000 signing bonus to stay. He was trying to talk me out of leaving really bad. And of course, that was tempting for about 30 seconds, but, no, it was a big step, but you know, it was, looking back, it was the best thing we've ever did.
Tell me about a significant change in you as a leader in the last 10 years.
Well, there's been so many, you know, it seems like you're constantly learn and grow with different circumstances, different employee situations, different customer situations. You start to realize the areas that you're strong in and the areas that you're weak in and counting on employees to do stuff. You know, I think I've become, you know, I used to think that I was an appreciative person, but I think I've really become more appreciative and expressing that to my staff, you know, even in the last few years, because, you know, we've got 40-some employees, and you can certainly, you know, stop and pound your chest a little bit if you want to, but ultimately, you know, you're only as good as your weakest link in your last customer experience. And unfortunately, you know, working on thousands of cars every month at 6 locations, you know, even just a fraction of 1% of unhappy customers still gets me today. It's still one of those things that bothers me. And so I never get to a point where you just sit back and say, you know what, we've got this all figured out, because, you know, you're constantly training employees and, you know, just trying to strive to take care of every single customer, not let one slip through the cracks.
So you're unique because you have multi shops, but what are the daily tasks that you do every day that create value for the business?
Really, for me now, I do a lot of recruiting and a lot of coaching and team building. I love, you know, one-on-one conversations with my staff. I like pulling them aside and just encouraging them, patting them on the back, you know, buying, you know, lunch, bringing in breakfast, encouraging them, getting feedback from them on their successes. You know, my days are never the same. And I try to get to every location somewhat regularly. And I want to have a personal relationship with every single employee. And I want them, they all have my cell phone number. I want feedback from them. I want to know if something's not right personally or in their location. So really, probably the answer to that is just a focus on individual relationships with each of my guys.
Excellent. Let's dive into the world of being a multi-shop owner. What started you thinking about having your first branch or additional store? What happened?
Well, it was kind of an awkward situation. We were in a weird little warehouse building, which was actually our third stop from the time I started working all by myself, but our first legitimate store where I had started gaining employees and stuff was in a warehouse building, and I never really thought that I had a lot of security there. I was just, you know, on a lease, and I wanted to buy my own building. We had a big account that was coming into that location, and so I started looking at other locations, and I brought in a key employee who's now our general manager, my brother Jason, and having somebody like him on staff that I could trust allowed me to kind of look at other possibilities. But, you know, ultimately, when you look at a second location, to think back, you know, we were just trying to standardize everything, you know, with multiple employees. And so we had checklists and, you know, just basic things for checks and balances with the team. And as you start getting into that systematic approach, I didn't realize what was happening, but we were developing a system and a way of dealing with situations. And just all of a sudden, you know, light bulb goes off. It's like, well, I think we could duplicate this. Uh-huh. But it actually, you know, the impetus for it originally was we had a big account that was coming to that particular warehouse building, and they had big buses and stuff in it. And we wanted to move, but the building that we were looking at wouldn't facilitate those.
So what you're saying is you needed more room, and you ended up trying to find a bigger place, but you kept both.
Exactly. We got down to it, and I said, "Hey, what if we just kept both locations, and you can run one, and I'll get the other one started." And it was, I guess, I like to say it was a great epiphany, but we kind of stumbled upon it actually.
So systems, processes, procedures—that's one of the keys to making all this work, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we didn't want to have customers go in to one location and get one experience and go to another location and have a different experience. And that was really critical, even as far as like pricing out jobs and stuff. We didn't want to necessarily compete against ourselves as well. And that was a tangible consideration back then.
What are two internal prerequisites for you to say, hey, we're ready to branch out again? I mean, because you've done it multiple times. Take me to that meeting in your mind.
I'll take you to the meeting with my wife.
Okay.
It's actually like the craziness of the new addition has to fade away and be in the distant memory before I can start thinking about it. So now, you know, it's a bit crazy for a year when you add a new location, and you'd like to think that you know, after it's all done, you look back, it's like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But it is a tough process. But
So are you saying it takes about a year to just find stability in the rumble of the force that happens when you grow?
A minimum, yeah. I'd say a minimum of a year. That's been our experience. But, you know, you have to have a stable base, and the existing locations have to be stable. I cannot personally consider anything else until I know that I've got a solid core with some contingencies in place. At the existing locations, and then at that point I can free my mind to think of other options. So, like I say, you have to be a little bit short-sighted or have short memory loss or whatever you call that.
You're getting ready to consider another location, Jeff. What are the two keys to picking the right spot?
Physically, you know, it's not hard to look at a map and see where we're at and where we're not, and, you know, where there's activity or, you know, opportunity. I think even beyond that, though, you know, we don't want to open up a location, you know, within a mile of our store necessarily, but, you know, it just has to be a unique opportunity. And we've looked at several. You know, there has to be value there. There has to be opportunity there. Almost think of it like buying a repairable vehicle. You know, you have to see the upside. You can't buy, you know, I'm not going to walk into something and find something at its peak performance. Everything's in place and spend, you know, a couple million dollars or $1 million for something. What I've been looking for is an opportunity where there's upside, there's potential, there's some history, you know, not something that's just been open for a year, you know.
Are you starting from scratch, or are you buying businesses?
I'm sorry, yeah, existing businesses.
Okay,
yeah,
that's how you've grown.
That's how we've grown, exactly.
And that's why the used car analogy, there's got to be something there to build on.
Right, exactly.
Did you ever look at the demographics, the income levels of the market that you're going to serve?
I suppose if I had a business degree and more education, I probably would do some of that. You know, the ones that I've done, you know, probably the four or so that we've looked at have been just very unique individual opportunities that didn't really require too deep of analysis as far as the business side of it. And just to see the potential, you know, the customer list size, how they've been operating, kind of what's their story. And it really is about being, for me, it's been opportunistic and not so much picking something that I want and then trying to pursue it like I want that location.
Within your first 3 months of getting into a location that needs your leadership and your guidance, what kind of marketing are you throwing at the marketplace and the customer base to get them on board and to get those numbers where you want them to be?
Sure. One of the first things that we do is get their customer base, and we draft a letter signed from the previous owner or manager, key employee, and we put both of our logos on there, and it's just a nice letter, kind of a warm handoff with an incentive, and that's how we start it all out. If we have emails, of course, we put them into our email program and get them, you know, in the loop as far as our regular communications. Mm-hmm. But the letter is the key thing. And, you know, I tell the guys, you get one chance to make a first impression. And, you know, I think we found that some of the best customers of these existing businesses are some of the first ones that walk through the door and probably the most vocal. And so you have to get it right from the beginning. So,
do they come back to test you? You know, we've gone there for a while. We stopped going. You know they stopped going because you see opportunity in the business. They walk in the door to give you another chance because there's new ownership.
Yeah.
Do you hear a lot of that? Hey, we're going to give you a shot. Now you're a new guy here?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you can't walk in the door with a reputation for that location, but you can encourage customers to look at your reputation at your other locations. And that does help.
So my curiosity says, did you win the lottery, or how do you consider financing options from your bank, SBA, the former owner? What's your preferred method?
Well, I think the only way that I've done this, the only way that I've done this going forward has been seller financing.
Okay.
And I believe in that wholeheartedly. I'm not a big bank guy, first of all. Banks, my experience with a bank on a transaction like purchasing a business, they don't like blue sky. They like collateral, and in the locations that I've, or the businesses that I've purchased, have been renting customers or renting, you know, renters in a property. So
yep,
I'm not purchasing real estate.
Nope.
So the collateral is a really big deal for the bank, and I just haven't found that to work. You need a lot of cash down. So, you know, with the contract for deed with the seller financing, it's usually pretty flawless. You get a lawyer, you write it up, you come to terms, you agree on the cost for the inventory, the equipment, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's literally you and somebody else that's probably a lot like you. And you just sit down and say, this is what I think, and this is what he thinks. And it's pretty authentic. And
how long does it take to put a deal together?
Depends on how close the price is to what you want to pay. You know,
right.
the deal down in Florida, I went through the broker quite a bit. And, you know, you've got everything. Everything is on the table. That's the great part about it. So you can talk about the lease. You can craft a deal any way that your imagination can come up with a deal. And, you know, so if you want to have a lower rent for a couple of years like we did in Florida, you know, that's part of the deal. I'd like to have the rent be, you know, $4,000 a month for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I'll give you this much down. You can do like secondary financing. So maybe, you know, if you're borrowing, say it's $150,000, you give them $50,000 down, and then maybe the, you know, $25,000 over a year, and then the rest of the $75,000 over 10 years. I mean, you can get really creative, and I think that's the great part about it. It's literally you and somebody else coming up with terms, and, you know, you have to build trust with them, of course.
Making a deal. How many deals did you ever make on a napkin?
I remember where I was standing and communicating with the broker, you know, negotiating with him on this deal down here. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I found that to be a really fun time for me, just talking with them, because you got to have a reason why you're offering them less. Of course, you're not going to offer them more than they want. So if you're offering them less, you better be prepared, you know, and that's, I guess, maybe an advantage that I have over, some people. I've done this a few times, so I kind of know what equipment should go for and what blue sky is worth and customer lists and all that kind of stuff. So,
how many deals are out there? Just hundreds, thousands of them waiting to be, you know, considered?
I don't know. You know, if you look on Craigslist, there's a lot of shops for sale. There's, like I said, I've looked at several. There's one kind of on the table right now. The guy wants a lot of money. there's not really much, you know, room for growth.
How do you determine that, if there's room for growth?
By looking at the numbers.
All right. You're looking at his numbers, you're looking at his productivity, and you're asking yourself, can I do anything else? Can I bring my systems, Jeff Matt's stuff, to this place and add 20-30% to cover my nut?
Exactly. Looking at their expenses, you know, you sign a non-compete or a non-disclosure, and then they give you the financials. And we have standardized financial chart of accounts in QuickBooks. And
yeah.
So we can easily, or not easily, I mean, sometimes it takes a little bit of work, get their numbers into our format, how we look at them and see, mm-hmm. All right, is there opportunity here? Are they charging enough for parts? Are they charging enough for labor? How are they paying their employees? How are they paying their manager? And those are the things that you can change overnight that can make a business profitable, you know, if you don't otherwise know.
So you're breaking down or normalizing their P&L into your business structure so you can make sense of it.
Exactly, yeah. Yep.
Well, that's exactly what to do. Now, do you build a business plan around that then? If you're not going to a bank who doesn't want to see all this stuff from you,
right.
Are you coming up with a business plan? You do an acquisition. You put a manager in place. Does he have a set of budgets and guidelines to follow to get to that plateau you're looking for?
Well, that's one of the things with the multi-store business format is our managers, our location managers, aren't really involved in that process. They're specifically focused on the customer experience coming through that door, managing the property, managing the transaction. I've got a controller that's intimately involved in these transactions as well as a general manager. And we sit down and look at it and we say, this is where their numbers are at, their gross profits at, and what can we do with this? This is how they're paying their guys, and this is how we can change that. This is how this can be better.
But there's no daily KPIs that the managers strive for?
The managers, we have an open book policy at our company. So we publish every month an abbreviated financial statement so they can see all their key numbers, absolutely, and
right.
They can see them against all of the other locations.
Okay.
So they definitely know what is, you know, what the benchmarks are. And of course, a lot of the benchmarks in the automotive industry are focused around your parts gross profit and your labor gross profit. The labor gross profit's typically something that the owner structures when he hires employees, and so they don't really have to deal with that. So really, most of it comes down to the parts and parts acquisition, inventorying, that kind of stuff, and of course, how you handle your leads, how you handle your phone calls, the people that stop in, and they're focused on that, and
mm-hmm.
They look at the monthly numbers, monthly. I try not to let them get too wrapped up in percentages and stuff. I tell them, we don't pay our bills with percentages. We pay them with dollars.
Bingo.
And they are empowered on the front counter, focused primarily on taking advantage of every opportunity that presents itself, keeping the guys in the shop busy. And
mm-hmm.
Not everybody is, a full list price customer. There's wholesale customers.
Mm-hmm.
There's free stuff. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that.
Are managers paid then like an owner, a performance bonus or anything?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So they've got a lot in it to help you grow your business.
Absolutely. Yeah, it'd be foolish not to do it. And honestly, that's probably the secret to how I'm able to have 6 locations and not have to literally check in with somebody every single day, be looking over their shoulder. They're motivated for the same things that I am.
I would guess you said earlier in the podcast that one of the things you do almost every day is recruit. And that to me, I guess when you get to be, have 5-6 places like you, right? 6?
Yeah.
You're always looking. I mean, is it you're always looking for good techs? What is it that you're recruiting for?
Well, it's hard to find good technicians for sure. It's also hard to find good managers. I think of it like if I had one location, it'd be like, it'd be easy to fill up a little sedan, get 4 people in the car and start driving down the road and you're driving and they're all right by you. For me, that's, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's a smaller hurdle than literally filling up a bus full of good employees, so people are constantly getting on and off the bus and I got to be ready to have somebody step in with, short notice. So it's technicians, service advisors, and managers.
Got it. Jeff, what are you doing to bring FaceTime to your entire team of 40 people? Do you get in front of them often? Do you stop at the shops and make sure you listen to what's going on there? Tell me about that.
Well, my general manager and I both float around between locations. He's my brother. We're a lot alike. He's great with the team. He's been with me a long time.
Okay, so he's filling that role for you.
Yeah, he's doing that, and I'm doing it as well. When I'm, you know, if I'm, you know, I'm at the shop every single day. I seldom take weekdays off, but I'm constantly at the locations. I don't come there and just sit in the office. I'm walking around, chatting with the guys, you know, and connecting and just giving them an opportunity to, you know, to share with me whatever's going on.
So you're a systems guy because you have to be with multiple stores and great processes, procedures. You have any really great, unique workflow system that universally you've implemented in all of the branches that you would say that's what makes the magic at our place?
I wouldn't say that we've got a unique system because I'm part of a 20 group, the bottom line impact group. And so I've been in there for 12 years. I've been to 30 some shops over 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of different systems, if you're actually talking about workflow, paper flow systems.
Yep.
And I guess I wouldn't say that we've got anything, you know, more unique than somebody else. But, you know, I guess the trick is having somebody, a good leader at the shop that is aware of everything that's going on and conscientious.
What's been the benefit to you to be in a 20 group and be at other guys' shops and learn from each other?
It's immense. You know, that is the single one thing that I've done personally, professionally, that has helped me get to where I'm at, is being in a 20 group. We've got a great facilitator. John Waffler is his name. I give him a lot of credit, probably the most credit of anybody that's helped me get where I'm at, coaching and then just rubbing shoulders with other successful business owners. You know, I can call any one of them at any time. They can call me. We share everything. That's the benchmarking. It's best practices, and that has probably been the biggest secret to my success at this point.
Excellent. Recruitment and retention of your customer. Give me one great tactic that you use for recruitment and one great tactic that you use to retain.
Well, I'll start with retaining. You know, we've been collecting email addresses for a long time, and so we feel that, you know, we need to reach out to those customers at least, you know, once a month. And so we always send out some kind of an incentive and communication. We've used Facebook, I think, as well as probably any independent shop that I've seen anywhere. And we've got a lot of people that follow it. I've got a gal that works part-time for me that does that exclusively, along with some other things that she helps me with. And so we try to build a little bit of a community there and some transparency. And when it comes to actual, like, new customer attraction, you know, we've just got some basic things. I guess if I had a reputation for any one thing, is that I don't waste money on advertising. I want to be able to track everything. And there's so many opportunities that we get presented with that are supposedly, you know, golden opportunities. And, you know, from checkout receipts to cable TV, sports teams, you name it. There's so many things out there. And I guess the one thing that I probably have done, I think, well, is just said no to a lot of things and just basically get it down to a few things. We do postcards, and we feel that our best customers are within a mile to maybe at the most 3 miles of our locations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our backyard, and we're the convenient shop for them. So we want them to hear from us. So we communicate every 60, 90 days with a nice professionally done postcard. And that's the one thing that we do that is tangible. We also are in networking groups. That's been an easy thing, you know, for our guys. So those are two things that I would say are must-dos for any shop owner.
How do you find the work-life balance?
I think it's been fine. Again, if my wife was on the podcast, she would say that I work all the time. However, you know, with a smartphone, you can do a lot of stuff. So I can respond to stuff quickly. I don't put in long hours. I take a lot of pride in that. I work a pretty normal schedule. I've got a really good crew, core group of guys that I can count on, and gals that that make me look good.
But when you started, I bet you worked 12-hour days or more. Yeah. So.
Oh, absolutely.
You've evolved. Yeah. You've evolved.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are still long days, trust me. And there's long weekends. It's been a long summer. We've been doing, you know, the expansion and exchanging out a couple liters. And it's been a fast summer. I don't remember much of it because we've been working so much trying to get people going. But
I know that I'm discussing this with you right now in Florida. And so I wonder why he opened his first Southern branch in St. Petersburg from Minneapolis.
It's a hot summer down here, for sure.
Yeah, that was my point. Yeah, it's of course, people always go north in the summer, and hell, you're down there in the summer building your new branch. Are you happy with what's going on with it?
I am. I'm really happy. You have to be patient, and you got to remind yourself of the big picture, that it's long-term, and... you know, hiring is a complicated thing. A lot of people have looked at it a lot of different ways. They've profiled and, you know, done all kinds of things to try to find the ideal employee. And again, maybe it's just a really oversimplified view, or maybe I'm just naive, but, you know, I just try to make a good judgment, interview a lot of people, and ultimately you never really know who you got till they walk through that door. So we've done some rolling starts, and, you know, that seems to work, but... it's all about getting the right people and just remembering that it's a long-term battle and, you know, you'll have some setbacks, but, you know, it's all about the people.
Do you do a lot of community involvement where your stores are?
We really try to be that business. We've done it over the years. We've been very proud with a nonprofit called Free to Be, which has become Cars for Neighbors. And we hosted in our shop for 12 years, volunteers that have come in, 2 Saturdays a month. We've been a drop-off site, so there's been car repairs that have been fixed. This organization currently has given away almost a thousand, they're nearing 1,000 vehicles that they've donated in the one county that 2 of our shops are in. And beyond that, thousands of repairs, and we were happy to host that event for 12-plus years. You know, and I mean, beyond that, you know, we support other organizations, and we're really, really proud of that. And our, you know, the team really rallies around those convictions that I have, and others, other leadership that we have in the company have, and supporting, you know, just different community.
What a great impact on the community. You should be very proud of that.
Thank you.
So I've really enjoyed our time together. It's been great. And I have one more question for you. It's going to be the toughest one I've asked so far.
Shoot it.
Jeff, what is your why?
Well, I feel like, you know, each of us has been given different gifts and talents. And you asked me early on kind of how I differentiated myself, I think was the question. And communication was, I think, my answer. And I feel like I've been given a lot. I've got a great wife, great kids, great family and parents, and a great family business. And I really, truly believe that there's a void out there in the automotive industry for places that people can go in and just that they can trust to get their car fixed. And I talked to my guys about this, you know, that if we were to go out of business tomorrow and just shut down for whatever reason, I ask my guys, I say, where would you recommend that your mom bring her vehicle to get it repaired if Victory disappeared tomorrow? And just about every one of them would scratch their head and say, I don't know. I don't know there's a place that I would send somebody that they can trust. So I want to be that place. I want to be everything. I want to be the best in this industry, offer all of the benefits, have the best paid guys, the best reputation. We're just driven to be the best. And I know there's a lot of people like me out there. And ultimately, who will ever know if you're the best? But it's literally just a personal drive to maximize the gifts that I've been given and try to create a great culture at Victory where our employees can come in and enjoy working and, you know, build up a retirement and have a home away from home, a family away from home. And I think that we're well on our way there. Proud of every employee that's come on board and helped with the dream that I've had. And I want that. I want to be the best. I'm just driven to be the best.
What a great answer. You basically served up the fact that there would be a void in the marketplace, in the mind of your people, if Victory didn't exist? And that really speaks huge volumes to the culture that you're building. So congratulations to you on that. And I can't tell you how much I've appreciated you being on, Jeff. Thanks a ton.
It's been great. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate your giving me a chance to share the Victory story.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from another inspiring aftermarket professional. Until next time.